You know how sometimes history gets presented like this perfect blueprint, a clear plan that, well, just unfolded exactly as intended.
Like it was all neat and tidy.
Exactly. But then you dig just a little bit deeper, look at the actual experience, on the ground, and things get, oh, they get messy.
Yeah, plans hit reality, people act in ways you don't expect, and that official story, it often looks really different from the messy truth.
Right. And that gap, that space between the grand idea and the lived experience.
That's where the real insights are, I think. It shows you the human element, definitely, the economic pressures, all those unintended consequences that can just completely reshape things.
Even the most like well thought out strategies. And that messy reality is exactly what we're plunging into today. We're doing a deep dive into a really fascinating historical case. It's the attempt to settle German agricultural colonists in the Zamoście state in Galicia that was part of the Austrian partition of Poland right at the very end of the 18th century.
And this deep dive, it's based on a, well, a really detailed academic article. Someone went deep into the archives to figure out what actually went down with this specific colonization effort.
So our mission for you today is to unpack the official reasons behind this plan, look at what was written down in the agreements, the formal stuff.
The blueprint, basically.
Yeah, the blueprint. And then, crucially, compare that to the actual situation, which was often contradictory for the settlers, for the estate hosting them. We want to reveal that contrast between theory and practice.
That gap again.
That gap again. Okay, let's unpack this.
So maybe start with the context. The Austrian Empire wasn't exactly new to this whole colonization idea in Galicia.
No, not at all. They'd started earlier, back in 1774, under Empress Maria Theresa, though back then it was more focused on merchants, artisans. Zamosis was actually mentioned even then.
Right, but things really kicked into high gear, you could say, under Emperor Joseph II from 1781 onwards.
And his focus was different.
Yeah, much stronger, explicit focus on bringing in farmers, agricultural settlers.
And the official goals were, well, they were pretty blunt about it, weren't they?
Oh, absolutely. The sources are very clear. They talk about Germanization.
Yeah.
Explicitly call it a desirable means of Germanization.
Wow.
Yeah. The aims were, increase the population, weaken Polish national identity, create a loyal base of German administrators, workers.
And the farmers specifically, I remember reading, they saw them as.
As living textbooks,
Yeah.
sort of, they were meant to be teachers of the Polish peasants. That's direct quote.
Teachers of the Polish peasants. That's quite a perspective.
It is.
And to get the Polish landowners, like the Zamoście state, on board with this, the Austrian authorities, they really put on a charm offensive, didn't they?
They did. Used propaganda that sounded surprisingly conciliatory. They really needed these private estates to participate.
So they stressed all the supposed benefits.
Right. German settlers were presented as, more industrious, having better customs, being obedient. And this was a big one, abstaining from alcohol.
Which was directly contrasted with, how do they put it?
The source says, lazy and disobedient Polish peasants. It was a stark contrast they were painting.
So the whole idea was that having these German settlers around would be an essential school for the local Poles.
Exactly. Cultural and behavioral engineering, basically, disguised as agricultural improvement.
And there were financial carrots too, right?
Oh, yeah. Big ones. Landowners were promised 50 Reinerzloty per colonist family, straight from the treasury.
And some of that money went to the owner.
Supposedly for improvement. And the propaganda even claimed the settlers themselves would arrive, already wealthy, which wasn't always the case.
So the pitch to the landowners was get cash, get these supposedly ideal farmers who will improve your existing workforce, and hey, it's all part of the emperor's grand vision.
Pretty much. And on paper, what the landowner had to do looked fairly reasonable.
They got to decide the land size, right? Which could be relatively small.
Yeah, as little as a quarter or even a half quarter shan.
Okay, remind us what's a shan roughly.
It's a historical Polish land measure. It varied, but think maybe 25 to 45 acres, something like that. So a quarter or half quarter shan, that's definitely on the smaller side for a farm.
Got it. And the landowner also had to provide free building materials,
And grant these settlers exemptions from estate dues for several years.
which they presented as totally normal for new settlements.
Right. Nothing unusual here, folks.
So why would a huge established estate like Zamosic even consider this? What was in it for them, really?
Well, you have to remember, many private estates in Galicia were actually struggling financially at this time.
Oh, really? Why?
A big factor was the mass escape of serfs. They were losing their labor force. So bringing in outside labor, especially these supposedly hardworking German colonists, seemed like a potential solution.
A way to develop unused land and maybe boost income.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which brings us to Andrzej Zamoyski, the former chancellor, head of this massive estate, the Ordinacja Zamojska.
He was a key target for this government propaganda.
Definitely. And he did want to develop empty lands. The Austrian government was, well, ecstatic when he first agreed in 1784 just to take two German cloth shearers. Not even farmers yet.
Just two. And they made a big deal out of it.
Oh, yeah. Called it a patriotic activity, publicized it widely, hoping others would follow his example.
But why did he agree to the farmers later? The article seemed a bit unsure about his exact reason.
It admits uncertainty, yeah. It speculates, though. Was he trying to curry favor with the emperor, maybe get the estate's special status confirmed?
Plausible.
Or was he genuinely buying into that whole idea of German efficiency? Or maybe just trying to revitalize lands damaged by wars?
Or perhaps it was an experiment, like testing out small, self-sufficient farms.
That's another possibility. Or maybe, just maybe, he needed the money, the 50 zloty per family, because the estate's finances, well, they weren't exactly stellar.
So a mix of potential reasons. But whatever it was, he eventually committed. How many families?
80 farmer families agreed upon in the autumn of 1784.
Okay, so we've got the background, the motivations. Let's get into the blueprint itself. What did those agreements actually lay out?
Right, the plan on paper. There were two key ones. First, the September 14, 1784 agreement. That one got Emperor Joseph II's personal approval.
An important stamp.
Then there was a follow-up. A supplementary one, May 1st, 1785. And that one really became the practical basis for how things were supposed to run.
And Zamoyski also settled some German artisans, but that was separate.
Yeah, they were in the town of Zamoyszyc itself, a different kettle of fish from the farmers out in the villages we're focusing on.
Got it. So looking at the details for the farmers, they were incredibly specific, weren't they? Like the land amount.
Very precise.
Yeah.
Each family was supposed to get land for 30 korzek sowing.
Explain korzek sowing again.
It's a measure of volume for grain. So korzek sowing defined the land area by how much seed it took. 30 korzek sowing worked out to roughly 23 morgs and 89 rods.
Okay, more units. Give us a sense of scale for a morg.
A morg is maybe around 1.4 acres, give or take. So 23 morgs.
Mm.
We're talking something like 32, 33 acres. A decent size for a family farm back then.
And that included space for the house, garden, meadow for hay, and cropland.
Right. And importantly, the land wasn't sold outright. It was given for free under emphyteusis.
Which is like a...
Think of it as a perpetual hereditary lease. They held it forever, could pass it down, but the estate technically kept ultimate ownership, the dominium directum.
Giving them certain rights, like removal under specific conditions.
Exactly.
And where was this land supposed to come from? Initially, it sounded like existing fields.
The first agreement mentioned rent-paying fields and the estate's own domain fields. But the 1785 one clarified it would be mainly wastelands and domain area.
Probably to soothe the local peasants who might worry about losing their own plots.
Very likely.
Now the rent, the shins, that system was pretty detailed too.
Oh yeah. They classified the land into three types based on yield. Class I was the best, 8 to 9 times return on seed. Class III was lower, 4 to 5 times.
And the rent was tied to that class?
For korzek sowing, yes. 55 kraj koro for class 1, down to 35 for class 3.
Okay, what's a kraj kar in context?
A small silver coin. Maybe think of 10 kraj koro as a rough daily wage for a laborer back then. So 35, 55 per unit, it suggests the rent reflected the land's value, its productivity.
And they didn't pay rent right away?
No, there's a 3-year exemption period. After that, rent was due twice a year, January 1st and July 1st, paid directly to the estate treasury.
And they had collective responsibility, like the whole village had to ensure the rent was paid.
Seems so, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And individual settlers were supposed to have notebooks, like rent books, to track payments. Very organized, on paper.
Oh, okay, beyond the rent. What else? The 1784 agreement mentioned some harvest work, but paid work.
Yes, 12 days a year, paid at 10 kraj koro a day. Seems straightforward.
But then, here's where it starts getting really interesting, right? Hinting at that gap. The 1785 agreement added corvée.
Bingo. Unpaid labor duties, the kind traditionally owed by peasants. After that 3-year grace period, they owed 8 days of foot corvée per year.
For what kind of tasks?
Working on estate buildings, mills, helping with the estate's own harvest or haymaking, supposedly capped at 2 days a week.
But wait, you mentioned something confusing from the source earlier. It said corvée, but then mentioned payment.
Yes. That's the head scratcher. The source calls it corvée, implies unpaid, but then says they were paid 10 kreikoro per day for it, the article doesn't fully clear it up.
So was it truly unpaid, just with a tiny allowance? Or was it really low-wage mandatory labor framed as a traditional duty?
We don't know for sure from this source, but it's definitely a point of tension. It was a mandatory service beyond their cash rent, whatever you call it.
Hmm, okay. And they also had other duties, like local peasants. Public works?
Yes, czar work for public works, and forest ban having to provide transport or quarter militia. Standard stuff for locals.
State taxes were separate?
Paid voluntarily by them. If they couldn't pay, the estate covered it, but the colonists had to work off the debt to the estate.
At a set rate, like 5 or 7.5 kreikoro a day.
Right. But crucially, the estate was explicitly forbidden from taking their kids or family members for forced labor on the main farm. That was a protection.
The plan also included housing, didn't it? Standardized houses.
Yeah. Each family was supposed to get a straw-roofed house. Chamber, kitchen, floor, brick stove, chimney. Built to a design used on the emperor's own estates, apparently.
Plus a stable.
Stable for 8 cattle. Slight difference in who built it between the two agreements, but it was promised. And a barn, too.
Colonists had to help build, but then maintain them.
Exactly. And the buildings were also under that perpetual lease, the emphyteusis.
And getting started. Equipment, animals. The estate helped initially.
They sowed the land free the first year, which was vital. But the colonists had to pay for the basic setup. Horses, oxen, cows, a sow, wagon, plow, tools.
But not up front.
No, the value was recorded and payment was deferred. Started after 6 years, paid back in 6 annual installments.
And the 1785 agreement added a rule about not selling the livestock.
Right. The quantity and type were fixed. Couldn't be sold without permission. Probably to make sure they kept the means to actually farm.
Seems logical. And to keep track of all this, these detailed land registers.
Yeah, in villages with 6 or more families, they recorded everything. Personal data, land details, rent, other dues, the imperial contribution.
And these registers were meant to be permanent. Eternal law.
That's the phrase used. Eternal validity. Changes were supposed to be noted separately, not altering the original entry. A real attempt at legal clarity and permanence.
Wow. The rules covered everyday stuff, too, like pastures.
Shared pastures, shared herdsman costs with the locals. Had to pay if their cattle caused damage. Promised special plots for small animals.
Firewood.
Free firewood from estate forests, but only fallen trees, stumps. 1 cart a week, usually. 2 in winter. Had to buy wood if that ran out.
What about services? Mills? Alcohol?
Paid the standard rate, 116th share. At estate mills, subject to the estate's alcohol monopoly, the propinacha, but promised good, cheap drinks.
Wells. Fishing.
Dug their own wells with estate materials. Forbidden from fishing in estate ponds. Pretty comprehensive control.
And local leadership. They could elect a headman.
Evoke, yeah, in villages with 6 or more families, subject to estate approval. Their job was to ensure compliance, but no pay, no perks for them.
Any other minor dues?
No tithe on the specific land they got, but a small fee, if they had their own hand millstones. Little things.
Okay, this sounds like a ton of rules. But you mentioned initial support was crucial, as many arrived poor.
Absolute vital. They got non-refundable food aid until their first harvest. 4 kreikoro per adult, 2 per child per day. Half cash, half in kind.
And this came from government subsidies.
Yeah, about 250 renish lati per family allocated for this. Plus free lodging when they first got there. Without this, many likely wouldn't have made it.
So the estate still had legal power over them.
Oh, yes. First instance, justice, like other serfs. And that ultimate ownership, dominium directum, meant they could remove colonists, but...
Only under specific conditions, right. And inheritance was allowed.
Yes, heirs could inherit. Eviction wasn't supposed to be arbitrary. Only for things like laziness and poor management or not paying rent for 2 years due to obvious instability.
And here's a key protection. Eviction needed higher approval.
Exactly. Required approval from the Zamoshit Circuit Office, the Austrian administration. Not just the landowner's call. That's significant.
There were other restrictions, too. On debt. Selling.
Couldn't take debt on the property for 15 years. Mm. After that, could sell, but only with estate knowledge. And the buyer had to be German and not already own land there.
Couldn't own 2 farms. And if they were forced out after 15 years.
Got 6 months to find a German buyer. If they failed, the estate could bring in another German, but crucially couldn't just add the land back to its own main farm.
So really trying to preserve these German settlements.
That was clearly the intent of the rules.
Okay, so that was the plan. Detailed, government-backed, specific terms, rights, obligations, protections. But what actually happened? How did this meet reality?
Well, right off the bat, the numbers don't quite line up. The agreement said 90 families. The 1800 census lists 100.
Why the difference?
The article speculates maybe some were earlier arrivals or just added unofficially. We have the breakdown per village in 1800. Piesho Bezegi 8, Brodsteri 6, Hushkevuka 4, Korcho 11, Porsky 8, Rogomio 15, Rajanik 14, Satanik 16, Zamprong 18.
Adds up to 100. Those discrepancies caused issues later.
Yeah, led to efforts in the 19th century to try and regularize things based on that 1785 agreement.
And how did the local Polish peasants react to their arrival?
Anxiously, as you'd expect. Feared being evicted. The state council actually had to issue formal assurances that colonist land would come only from the estate's own land or wasteland, not existing peasant plots.
Trying to calm things down.
Mm-hmm. And there's a funny little side in the source about the local Jewish community facing potential issues themselves under certain laws.
What do they do?
Apparently, wealthier Jews paid taxes for poorer ones, and they might have even faked lists of beggars who'd supposedly left, basically tricking the authorities. Shows how different groups adapted.
Clever maneuvering. Was it easy for the estate to actually implement the plan, setting up these farms?
Not at all. Just preparing the fields was tough. They lacked tools, so it meant burdening the existing corvée peasants even more. Sometimes they had to hire plows from other villages.
Which costs money.
Fair bit, yeah. 300 zloty polski mentioned for one instance. Providing building wood strained the forestry guys. Even just handing out the aid created admin work.
The article suggests it would have been worse if they'd actually tried to follow the plan perfectly.
That's the implication. The reality was already messy, even with corners likely being cut.
And deviations from the agreements, were they rare?
Far from it. Happened frequently on both sides.
Yes.
The estate administration and the colonists. The problems were big enough that later admin actions had to specifically invoke the 1785 agreement to fix things.
Okay, let's look at the estate's side first. What kind of abuses happened?
Especially common when parts of the estate were leased out. Lessees often prioritized their own profits. Common issues were imposing extra charges, duties not in the contract.
And the big one, converting rent into labor.
Yes, converting cash kins into corvée became widespread. Settlers complained bitterly, saying these were feudal burdens they didn't know in their own country.
Is there a specific example?
Yes, for Horizal Polskiego. Colonists there complained about forced corvée. The estate council flat out refused them.
Why? What was their reasoning?
Their explanation was really telling. They said the Horizal domain farm, quote, has quite extensive domain fields and meadows. Therefore, it needs proprietors on the corvée lands, not rent payers.
Wow. Basically, we need your free labor more than your cash, so deal with it.
Pretty much. Shows how the estate's immediate needs just steamrolled the written agreement.
Okay, so the estate wasn't sticking to the plan. What about the colonists? Did they live up to that propaganda? Calm, obedient, industrious?
Well, the reality didn't quite match the hype. After their 3-year rent exemption ended, they weren't just quietly paying up.
No. What did they do?
The source says they bargained over payments, used every possible means to avoid paying their rent.
Is there an example of that?
Yeah, in Satanicus. Some settlers there shared fields with Polish peasants. But they reportedly left their own contracted land fallow.
Why?
Claimed they couldn't pay rent due to poor harvests on their own land. But it looks less like genuine hardship and more like a tactic, maybe. Using other resources while dodging their own obligations.
Were there other problems with the colonists?
Oh, yeah. Reports of neglecting their farms, some farms failing completely, settlers deserting, even just a few years after arriving.
And did they treat the estate's resources any better than the locals, like the forests?
Yep. Just like the Polish peasants, they were reported destroying estate forests. And sometimes it got violent.
Violent? How so?
Source gives examples. Rajanik settlers severely beat foresters. And in another case, settlers from Pius hired a soldier who actually attacked a forester with an axe.
Good grief. So much for calmness. What about the drinking? The propaganda stressed sobriety.
Drunkenness was reported as common. Specifically mentioned for Biosho Brzegi and Satanic settlers, and cited as a reason some farms failed.
So the idealized image was really crumbling. Did they follow the rules on record keeping? The notebooks, the registers?
Not really. Ignored keeping the land registers and payment notebooks. Took building materials for things beyond the agreed house, stable, barn.
And changed ownership without permission.
Yeah, informal transfers, not following the official procedures.
So it sounds like this lack of control with both sides bending or breaking rules, it created a weird situation.
Exactly. An environment ripe for mutual exploitation, you could say. The estate used the ambiguity to demand more free labor, more corvée.
And the colonists.
Even though they risked their special status by not sticking to the contract, they gained more freedom in practice, managed their holdings more autonomously.
And the article mentioned territorial expansion.
Yeah, later surveys in the 19th century found significant land surpluses on colonist farms compared to their original grants. They somehow acquired more land.
And they resisted control, partly because they had that Austrian admin support.
That seems to be the dynamic. They knew they had some backup, which maybe emboldened them.
So looking back at this whole experiment, this deep dive, what are the main takeaways? What does it all mean?
Well, assessing their economic state right at the end of the 18th century is tough. The sources just aren't detailed enough.
But later reports give some clues.
Yeah, a 19th century report on descendants suggests they were doing quite well by then. Good buildings, decent livestock, 6 horses, 5 to 8 cows, lots of pigs on average.
So mostly successful eventually.
Assessments were generally positive, very well, or well for most, though some had failed, and drunkenness was often blamed in those cases in that later report.
And was this success because they were just better farmers?
Not necessarily. The article suggests their better situation later was likely due to that quite comprehensive protection from the Austrian administration. That gave them an edge.
Allowed them to compete effectively with local peasants who didn't have that buffer.
Potentially, yes.
But in the late 18th century itself, was there evidence their farming was actually better?
The sources are tellingly silent on that. No mention of superior methods or significantly better results compared to locals back then.
Which suggests?
Probably no major difference in technique or productivity initially. They took loans too, like the Polish peasants. Doesn't screen special economic initiative in that early period.
So did the estate feel like they got their money's worth? Were they happy with these supposedly superior settlers?
It seems the estate manager was pretty disappointed, actually.
What's the evidence for that?
It's quite telling. The estate started settling local people, meaning Polish peasants, on lands that German colonists had abandoned.
But wait, wasn't that against the agreement? Didn't new settlers have to be German?
Exactly. It was explicitly against the agreement. By choosing to put Poles there instead, the estate was signaling they weren't prioritizing maintaining the German settlements as originally planned.
Yeah.
Their actions spoke louder than words.
And Zamoyski himself, the man who agreed to bring them in, his enthusiasm waned too.
Appears so.
Hmm.
He stopped accepting more German families even when they showed up later. 25 families arrived in Zamoyski's town in 1791, another 18 in 1792.
And the estate didn't place them.
No. And when local Jews suggested settling those 18 families on village land, the estate council's response was really significant.
What did they say?
They said, quote, "The peasants in the estate, who number several thousand, have the first right, not Jews." It clearly shows a shift back towards prioritizing the existing local population over bringing in more Germans.
Quite a turnaround from the initial patriotic activity.
Definitely.
But interestingly, despite this rocky start, German settlement did pick up again later.
It did, in the 19th century. More settlers were attracted, apparently by a good reputation of treatment that developed, especially after rent reforms in 1833. So the German presence did grow significantly later on.
But the verdict for the period we're focused on, that initial late 18th century wave.
The source is quite clear. This experience does not support those sometimes exaggerated positive views you find in some German historical writing about the special superior role of Germans in Polish agriculture at this time. The reality was far more complex and, frankly, less impressive.
And what about the Germanization goal? Did that work?
Not really. Not with this first wave. They largely Polonized quite rapidly, lost the German language.
The source mentioned Cytaniac specifically.
Yes. Descendants there lost the language. It was just a natural consequence of integrating into the overwhelmingly Polish local environment. Very few from that initial 1780s group remained a distinct German-speaking community.
So they didn't turn out to be that vital force or effective tool for Germanization that the Austrian government hoped for.
Not in this initial phase, no. It's a powerful example of how demographic and social reality on the ground can just completely overturn top-down strategic plans.
Absolutely. So we've really seen the two sides here. The official story, calculated government-backed plan, bring in superior settlers, transform agriculture, Germanized the area.
The neat blueprint.
Right. Contrasted with the complex, messy reality. Broken agreements, abuses on both sides, settlers not living up to the hype, the estate deviating, and totally unexpected outcomes like Polonization instead of Germanization.
It really is a fascinating reminder, isn't it, that grand plans, especially if they're based on, well, potentially biased ideas about groups of people, they often just don't survive contact with the real world.
Where individual interests, economic pressures, power dynamics just twist things. So for you listening, when you're sorting through information today, it could be a new company strategy, a government policy, even just marketing claims. Maybe think about this case.
Yeah, what's the gap between the stated goals, the glossy plan, and what's actually happening on the ground? Once human behavior and, you know, just unforeseen stuff gets involved.
This deep dive shows so vividly how easily the original intentions of any plan can get distorted by the pressures, the behaviors of those trying to implement it, and those living under its rules.
Absolutely. Both sides adapting, exploiting, changing the game.
So here's a final thought to leave you with. How might similar dynamics where the plan looks logical, maybe even ideal on paper, but gets complicated, maybe even twisted, by real-world incentives, power imbalances, the unpredictable ways people react, how might that be playing out in policies or projects happening right now?
Something to definitely consider as you encounter new information out there.